Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's Wednesday afternoon. Today's a very busy day, but I'm going to get around to doing the bio, which is being sponsored this week by Avrami Seeger, who is a real player. I'm going to become a Moshe Provenzalo, which he asked me to do. And I spoke a little bit about when we did the Mantua Zohar, but I'd like to discuss him a little bit more. A very fascinating figure. I would say one of those famous people you never heard about. And I mean that. And but Avrami Seeger has this publishing company. Let me put it this way. He just told me that, you know, I'm a big fan of Fleckless, of the Shumayava and his drushes, all the rest of it. And our sponsor today is the guy that has published in a nice edition, wonderful edition, the drushes of Fleckless and Elizer Fleckless, and but not his tshuvas. That's also good. But I did him the Chuv Miyava some time ago. I always complained they only have the old print. It's not exactly chicken scratch. I won't say that. But it's you know, kaka kaka. And there was a part that was never published, apparently. And that part was sold in the auction last week by Gnozim, an unpublished fourth part of the Shalzan Chuvah's Chuv Miyava. And now he tells me that he's publishing the whole shebang. So in other words, I don't know when, but you look forward, those who care about such things, which is myself and select others, we can look forward, I hope, to a new deluxe edition of the full business of a Shalos and Shubat Shuv Miyava, Elezer Fleckless, will probably be fascinating, because he marches to his own drummer, there's no question about that, and he was a Gadol Hador, and I'll wait till it comes out, and then I'll comment on it. But that's the right way to be. If you're going to be a player and buy these high-end, rare things, you put them out there for a Shusa Rabbim to be Mahana the public that cares about these important Sfarim of the past, which are not so well-known today and deserve to be, okay? So after that, it's up to you, the public, to buy it and read it, learn it. But I do have to say Yashikach on that. Okay, I think it was also due to Pachad Yitzchak last year, if I remember correctly, about that riot in Padua that I spoke about, but I don't know. But it's nice to have your own publishing company, I think. I've never had one. Okay, let's get down to business. We're talking about Moshe Provenzalo, who's very interesting in a number of ways. This is an Italian rabbi in the 1500s. I spoke about a lot of them, and Hitaka was in Mantua. Now, he wasn't the chief rabbi of the city. There was no such thing. In Italy, especially in northern Italy, you had a lot of times communities in which there were different edot, and each one had its own shul and own little kehillah, so to speak, subsumed within some kind of a united kehillah. But how united it was, you know, sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. Especially with the rabbis didn't respect each other, get along. And this was a plague that he had all through his life. That he was like a Rodney Dangerfield, didn't get no respect, even though, I mean, from the locals, that is to say, from the people, not from his kehillah, even though he did from the Gadol Hador. So you already see you're dealing with somebody that's a little unusual. As best now here's what I find fascinating. Here's somebody who lived, I don't know, something like 1500, 1575, something along those lines. You know, when they give you these dates, they don't know exactly. It's roughly that kind of era. See, lived a long life, and most of it in Mantua, which is in northern Italy. I had that important community I was speaking about before I went to Florida. And it was in the 1500s and 1600s, a Malcolm Torah big time. There was a war in the 1600s that messed everything up. You know, the city was sacked and raped and all that. But until then, it was steigy. They didn't have the good fortune of Padua or the other places to be within the territory of the Republic of Venice, which was nearby, because the Republic of Venice, as they said 100 times, had clever diplomats, And they always arranged it that their territory should never be invaded, which was always a trick. It means you have to dance on diplomatic eggshells in European politics to make sure you don't get on the wrong side of things and a foreign army invades you. So if you're Jewish and you live, for example, in Padua or Verona, you're okay, because since it belonged to Venice, there was no foreign troops coming. There was peace and quiet, even though not far away was wars. But if you lived in Mantua or Milan, in one of those places, there were wars fairly often. That was a bummer. Okay, now, here's the thing. Our hero, Moshe Provenzal, was the rabbi of the Italian community. Not the Ashkenazim, not the Sephardim, but the Italiani. Lo Azim, as they call it. Who is the Italian community? Where did they have Talmidei Chachamim? It's a good question. Italy's never really been a place, generally speaking. Well, I shouldn't say that, but Rome and these other places, not really known for heavy-duty Gedolei Ador. Once in a while, toast is red or something like that. But not really. But on the other hand, there was an influx of Jews in the 13, 1400s from France, from southern France. That's why his name is Provençal. He's from Provence, meaning his grandparents, great-grandparents, or whatever it was. In other words, during the 13, 1400s, again, the 13, 1400s, the Jews were progressively expelled from what was left in France. They had been kicked out of most of France already. And they finally got around to Provence and southern France. And where'd these people go? Some went to Italy. They included a number of heavy hitters. All right, some serious Talmidei Chacham. So that's the Masora of the Maharik, for example, who is earlier than our hero, but was a Provençal or French Jew, which brings back the Minhagim, I don't know, Machzer Vitri or something like that. And it's Ashkenaz of a very unique sort, different than the regular Ashkenaz, call it French, and they included some big Talmidei Chacham, some biggies, the Maharik being the best example. But just as we saw, the Maharik got into big fights with the Ashkenazim and his community, and there was so much fighting going on that the Duke kicked both of them out of town. So I'm just saying, it's not Pashut, let's put it that way. But as best as I can tell, and that's all I ever do on the podcast, as best as I can tell, these Provençal Jews were few in number, sort of blended into the Italiani, and provided them with some heavy learners. So they developed, in the 14, 1500s, some Italiani yeshivas. Not the Ashkenaz ones, which I spoke on many other occasions, like in Padua or places like that, Bologna. Because those were Ashkenazi yeshivas. They had one in Mantua, an Ashkenazi yeshiva. That's Yiddish speaking. Now, it's funny to me, because how does Yiddish sound in an Italian lilt, an Italian accent? You and I are familiar with Yiddish, like in America. Perhaps you come across some German Jews who speak Yiddish in a Germanic way, like Rabbi Nussbaum, or a Polish accent, Galiciana, Ungarische, Lithuania, and so on and so forth. We're used to the Yiddish with the accents of, Eastern Europe. You see, Baruch or Budich, that kind of thing. What's it like Italian, especially Italian Renaissance period? Mana Bubba's Dai, I don't know. it's probably interesting. But that's not who our hero was. He was not Ashkenazic. In the same way, Avadi Yosef couldn't participate in Moetzes Gedolei Torah because he didn't talk Yiddish. So our hero wasn't a Yiddish speaker. Moreover, here's the most interesting part. As far as I can tell, me, myself, and I, he never went to yeshiva. So he's self-taught. What does that mean? You're into learning. You hang around the base medrash of your synagogue or someplace like that. You cover shas at your own pace. You have questions. You talk to a scholar here, a scholar there. And you do it all yourself. Never went through Shir Aleph. Never was in a dormitory. Never was in yeshiva for a shmooze. All that sort of thing. And he grew up to be this big lamdan. I think, again, me, myself, and I think this was resented. Because that means if he ever paskin, not like the others, which happened sometimes. Because he was a posek who called it like he saw it. That is just who he was. He did. He became the rabbi of the Italian Kehillah, which wasn't large, but wasn't tiny. And eventually had his own little yeshiva over there In Italy, yeshiva could be a few guys sitting, talking, learning all day long. He clearly was a total bucking shas and poskim, that sort of thing. No question about it. No question about it. And people send him shas from all over the place. But he had no, he didn't have the inhibitions the one has in the yeshiva background, which is, I want to run this by my rabbim. I don't want to do something that's against the Messiah of my particular yeshiva. You know, I don't want to do this, that. Yeah, even America, you're Chaim Berliner, you're Neri Yisrael, you're Lakewood, you're this, that, and the other. He didn't have that. As I'll tell you again, as far as I can make out, even though they claim this guy learned with him a little bit, he was autodidact, which is really unusual, especially in the early modern era. And somebody should just do it on his own. Now, you get people like that once in a while. Recently, we had Herzog, Rav Herzog. Never went to yeshiva. Totally, you know, self-taught with his father and stuff like that. The Rambam never went to yeshiva, if you know. There are that type. But it makes the other yeshiva graduates, you know, jealous. Imagine, I'm just making this up. Suppose someone was in Baltimore. Suppose I was in Baltimore and a rabbi, and I never went to yeshiva, I just learned all my own. And meanwhile, you have all these other rabbis of synagogues who are graduates of, I don't know, Yisrael, Lakewood, this and the other. And they all hold one way in a certain din, let's say with ovens or Shabbos, or I don't know, something like that. And I don't hold that way. And I publish my opinions, and I back it up. Yeah, but you're going against the rove, you understand? You're going against the consensus. It's resented. Now, I could say like this. What do you resent me for? I brought my, you know, rias, my proofs. Here's what I base it on. You can't knock down my rias if you can. You know, in other words, I dare you, but if you do, you do. And then shut up. Don't get, that's not how people are. It's not from, is this, is that. You know, you can't trust him. He has no Masorah. I don't know, all kind of things like that. That who, as best as I can tell, that's what our hero labored under. And he was smart enough not to let it get under his skin, as far as I can tell. So he was, I guess, 40, 50 years, a rav of a kehillah in Mantua, not the only one. We know there was a big Ashkenazi community and they didn't get along with him, right? On the other hand, as I said before, you can borcha and shmurcha all you want. You can say you didn't go to yeshiva. Hakol Tzri Lemar Kataya. I mean, if you got it, you got it. If you know, you know, I mean, the Shas and the Rishonim and all that stuff, and you can present good arguments to back up your case, it's not easy for somebody to slug it up. And if they do in some kind of dochik dick away, which is often what happens, the public isn't stupid. They can tell it's dochik. You understand? I know myself, I'm not going to say a name. I know one or two rabbanim today. One passed away not long ago. Who published Shas and Shuvah's books. They say unusual things, but they're very solidly backed up. You know what I'm saying? It's a guy in Israel, it's one in America. You know, you can't machavek metahent, as they said. You know, I mean, here's his rias. You know, and he's not full of baloney. That's who Moshe Provenzalo was. The family name, I told you, comes from Provence, but they're Italian by the time he's living there and throughout the 1600s. So he became one of the rabbis in Italy. At the time, there were a lot of big rabbis in Italy. Now, not too far away, it was Padua, where you had the Mar in Padua, and the big yeshiva there and all the rest of it. That's true. But, you know, they viewed each other, I guess, as, you know, two players, as it were. Even though one's backed up by yeshiva and the hundreds of students, the other one isn't. Now, the thing is, the tshuvas of Moshe Provenzalo were around, and I've seen scholars in the past quote them from manuscript, but Machon Yerushalayim put it out in the late 80s and then recently printed it again. Okay? Machon Yerushalayim, which is good for them. I think it's Chelek Rishon. Is there a Chelek Sheni here? I can't tell. Maybe they're going to do more. I don't know. All right? And it's quite a work because it says Netach Alpik Kisriyat, Tir Feoris, Mar Makomus, Avtechus and Mavo. So in other words, they had to go around and collect here and there some of his famous tshuvas. He's got a famous one that was published long ago by Rifkin about playing ball on Shabbos, you know, where he goes, all the problems of playing ball on Shabbos. in a ballpark, by the way. He said they had a special place. You look up in the Shubas, especially in there. He is no Makobo, as I told you in Florida. You know, he says, I think you can publish his Zohar, but I don't know anything about it. And he's a straight Nigla type guy, because he calls as he sees it. Again, I'm just flipping around here, and yeah, Binyan Hanochas Tefillin B'chol HaMoed, that famous question, which started in Italy with the Rama Mipano and all those who were contemporaries of his, to start to say you can't wear Tefillin B'chol HaMoed, because the Zohar says it's a curse. And the Alkon de Litvak, I mean, you know, the non-mystics say, I'll be dim, straight by going by the Gemara, and regularly, you do put on Tefillin. And it goes back and forth. Want it? I'm just reading. This quote from the Zohar that Rabbi Kiba said, you don't put on Tefillin, it's baloney. So Rabbi Kiba asked him, "Gomer shabahayu laos al yidecha yasu shabas yonshim matzim os." Because Rabbi Kiba himself is the one who said the thing about the osos. You know, you can't have Shabbos itself, you know, so you don't need the tefillin. Benimsu dvar b'talmud shem medrash hanelam sosin says that. So you have a contradiction between what it says in one place and the other. El dvar meinu ikar lo bazar lo medrasham el tos yotzim yada kosei. Obviously, whoever copied out the Zohar. And remember, he's the guy that gave the okay to publish his Zohar. I mean, to print it. Whoever did it was a toast over, you know, mistaken in copying. And they put it in the printed edition of Zohar, but it's not really from Rabbi Kiva. And if you have something which is opposite of Befer Shagamar, you don't say, oh, we go by the Zohar, all the rest of it. It was a mistake. It's not really in the Zohar. That's what it is. So since if you go by the Gemara, if you work your way through the sugya, you see that you do put on tefillin chol hamoed. Call me Shana Rosalem. Now here he is, a rabbi of Italian community in Italy, in which some people do and some people don't. Jacob Katz is a very famous article that drew my attention. Hanochas tefillin b'chol hamoed. We talked about the fact that you had fights about this in Italy. I talked about this once again when we did Emmanuel Heiricke, because he died in connection with fights over that in the 1700s in Italy. But here's Provenzalo, who's not a Makobel at all. He says, call me Shane Rutzel, Anichan Yesh Lebez and Liyas, Lakos Ashtate Nasho, Kide Shekhaim Beis Mitzes, Asi Bisman, Kidin, call me Shemakan Azal Mene Matzo, Mishas Chiyuva. The guy says, I don't want to put on film for Kabbalistic reasons. The Bezin can beat the heck out of him. They're forcing him to put on tefillin. Val menichem b'bracha. And if he doesn't make a bracha, that's probably what some people did. Ein osa mitzvah kitikunim. That's also wrong. And on and on. So it knows he had no... And by the way, I'm just giving you the tail end. I mean, there's a whole tube on this. So he has all these different kind of very interesting questions. They really are interesting. If I read you a list of all of the shilas, they're most... I won't say they're unusual, but they're on parts of life, all of which are interesting. You understand? All of which are interesting. Anyhow, be that as it may, what's famous or controversial about Moshe Provenzalo is, and here's something interesting, and I think it's because he didn't go to yeshiva. That's my opinion. They tried to fire him a number of times, unsuccessfully, from his job. You don't find that very often in Jewish history. Very rarely. Okay? If somebody's a rov, and elected out of Beis Din, and then because he gets in disagreements with other Gedolim, the other Gedolim really tries to screw him over him and what do you call it, get him fired, right? I know they tried it with Abe Schitz, but that's a different story. With Yonas and Abe Schitz, they say he's a Shabtai Tzvi. That's a different thing, right? I'm not saying it's true. I'm saying that's what they said. So that's different. If you tell me your Rav is Mamash Apikiris, if that's your claim, then I hear, even secretly, then I hear where you say you tried to get the guy fired, disrobed, l'harmi menu atar, to strip the crown off his head. But nobody ever said that by Moshe Provenzalo. Everybody says he's a from guy. And everybody says he's a Talmud Chacham. But they didn't like certain sakim he did, or certain things that he did, and want to get him fired over that. Fired, I say. That's really unusual. Now, it didn't work. Real unusual. There are two famous cases, one of which is not so famous. The other one is very famous, except nobody's ever heard of it. The first one has to do with, in the 1550s, with Yosef Karr, believe it or not. And it's very complicated, so I can only give you the Russian program over here. I'm not going to, because it'd be an hour and a half. I really mean that. I'm just giving you a few of the Russian program. There was a case where Yosef Karr lived in Israel, as you know, in Tzfas, and he wanted his books published in the new technology called the printing press. And the place of the printing press was in Italy. So Yosef Karr used to ship his writings that he wanted printed from Israel, from Palestine, to Turkish Palestine by sea to Italy. That would be transported there. And he had a guy to do it. And there, this person or that person would see that it got printed. And then they would send back printed copies, to Tzfas. And of course, they would distribute them throughout the Jewish world as well. This is how the books of Yosef Karr circulated throughout Jewry during his lifetime. There's nothing wrong with that. So that's the process. By the way, I've told you, in the drushas of one of these contemporary Italian rabbis, drushas Mari Mitz, no, it's Shmuel Yehuda Katzenberg, the son of Maram Padua, has a famous set of 12 drushas, which I have now, as I say, I don't know why, but it was published in the Kudos, of all things. And he has a hesped for Yosef Karr, and he said, we used to help him publish this stuff. One time, a pirate captured a ship, and all the ksavim were lost. I don't know what he's talking about, but obviously, he's obviously not talking about the Shulchan Aruch or the Beis Yosef or the Ketzer Mishnah or something like that. Anyway, so here we have Yosef Karr, and he sent a guy, Moshe Ben Shushan, Sephardi, to Italy with the stuff, with the papers, to get printed, which costs money. So I can only assume they figured once you come to Italy, you'll hit up the Richie Riches, and you raise some money, and then with that money you do the printing job, because you have to pay the guy. That time was in Sabbioneta, which is close to Mantua. There's a printing press there, Hebrew printing press. Now, the story is very complicated, but apparently this Moshe Ben Shushan guy came, I think, with the Torah Choshen Mishpat, I believe it was. It wasn't the Shulchan Aruch, maybe it was the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't matter. And he borrowed money from Peter to pay Paul. No, he borrowed from this guy, he borrowed from that guy, from the third guy, and then he paid the first guy with the third guy, and he got into trouble financially. One was a guy. Yeah, it was what it was. And so they started to have court cases, to get the money back. And it's right near Mantua anyway. And so Moshe Provenzala, I think, convened the Besdin, and this guy should come and testify before it. And he didn't want to testify before it. And he put him in Cherem, because that's what standard practice if a Besdin calls you and you don't come, then you put him in Cherem. And he said, I'm in Cherem, you're in Cherem. Adrabah, as they call it. You're in Cherem because you put me in Cherem for the Shaloka Din. And there's all kinds of circumstances. It is in the Avkas Rochel, by the way, if you're interested. If you look it up, they just don't name names. That's all. And the whole messy business. And the result was he appealed to other rabbis in Italy. And the question was, can he force him to appear before his Beis Din, and more importantly, can he put a cherem on him if he fails to appear? No, it's technical stuff. And I think Yosef Karr, if I remember, backed his guy. And it was all hell broke loose. And they said, let's get him fired. Let's get him fired because he did something he's not supposed to do. I'll tell you again, that stinks to high heaven because you're not telling me he's not from. Tell me you don't agree with something he did as a matter of Beis Din policy. Yeah, but he's saying you're not listening to the other rabbis in Italy. He said, I don't have to listen to the other rabbis in Italy. That's what he said. I don't know as much as them, which is not false. And Rav Yosef Karr got involved in it. I think he backed his guy, but only because he backed his guy. Rav Yosef Karr liked our hero because Rav Yosef Karr actually, if I remember correctly, sent the Kesef Mishnah on the Rambam to him to have it published. So in other words, he trusted Moshe Provenzano. I hope I haven't confused you. But in this particular case, which blew up, you know, the A put B in the Cherem, B put A in the Cherem, and then all the rabbis are lining up on different sides of teams, the Orioles versus the Yankees. Which one is in Cherem? So if you have a rabbi that I hold is in Cherem, you shouldn't have him as your rabbi. The only thing is, nobody consulted the people of his own shul. You see? And so I think he was smart enough not to hit back hard. And so the people of the shul rallied to his side. And they said, you tell us that we should fire our rabbi? No, we say no. No, he was supported by his own group. These are crazy politics I'm talking about over here, right? And he kind of survived that. A few years later, popped up this big scandal called the Ghetto of Venice. You know, you've heard of the Ghetto of Cleves. Maybe you've heard of the Ghetto of Vienna I talked about. There's another one called the Ghetto of Venice. Or as it's called, the Tamari-Venturoso affair. The Shaaria, the scandal. The Tamari-Venturoso scandal. Which was a biggie. There was like a dozen of these in Italy in the 1500s. There's the Mikvah at Rovigo. There's a whole bunch. Yeah, and the reason is they had these rabbis in small towns. They had nothing better to do. So they wrote these long contracts in what they held on this and that particular, you know, machlokes. And a lot of it survived. It's in Jerusalem in the Machon LeTatzlumi Kitvei Yad, and so on and so forth. But I was interested in it. Anyway, it was this messy marriage. There was a guy, Tamari, Yosef Tamari. He lived in Venice. He was a doctor, an MD. He was a big yachtsman, a richy rich. And he didn't get along with Tamar and Padua so well, because they told him to do something. He didn't listen. I think he bought a house outside the ghetto, which was extremely unusual, because the Jews are not allowed to live outside the ghetto unless you have some serious pull. I mean, you have to have some. The Venetian government was pretty doggone anti-Semitic. If they made an exception to somebody, even if he's a big doctor, you had to know the right people and grease the right palms. I mean, that's just how it goes. You understand? And for some reason, the rest of the guild didn't like it, or he didn't ask permission for them, or something like that. There were rules, and he didn't follow the rules. But of course, he's the richy rich. You don't have to follow the rules. That's how it goes. So he had a fight for a number of years. I think the Myron Padua was like the Abbez, and they put him in Cherem, but he didn't care because nobody's going to listen to it. He had enough clout with the government of Venice that you don't want to cross him. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he could sick the bloodhounds on you. And so the community was afraid of him. That's who he was. We had such types. Now, he had a daughter, a young daughter, and she got engaged. Let me be more exact. She did Erusin. There's all kinds of different opinions about whether you do Erusin Kedushin at the same time like we do nowadays at different times. Moshe Provenzano, by the way, said, listen to this. The minig of the Italianis, they do Yibam and Nachalisa. It's funny. You know, I mean, you don't hear that. He said, that's the old Italian minig, which he knew. And he also had other things he disagreed with, the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, whatever the case is. But Havdalah and Nuschos and Davening, I won't go into that. Anyway, as far as this case is concerned, this guy Tamari, he got his daughter married, did Erusin, not Nisuin, with this guy, Venturoso, a Jewish guy from, you know, another part of Italy. Must have come from a Kashrut family. Otherwise, what shakas would he have with a richy rich like Tamari? So fine. And he had protects. He knew the Duke of this and the Duchess of that. As was the case with any richy rich wedding, a lot is financial. In other words, the Chassan side promises this, the Kala side promises that, so and so much money, so and so money with clothes. I mean, substantial amounts of money. So there was money involved in all this. After they did the Erusin, and a lot of this, by the way, has come out recently. The old historians didn't know all this. Somewhere along the line, the girl said, Moisel, I don't want him. I don't want him. Maybe the father had fights. I mean, the father already had financial fights with him. Maybe influenced the daughter. If she was a little girl, it's very likely. I wasn't there. I don't know. It's very suggestive, though. And so he started to say, give my daughter a get and give me all the money back. And whatever money you promised me, you have to deliver. And any money I promise you, I don't have to deliver. And the chasen, who was an Arus, not a Nasui, he started to get afraid because in Venice, this guy is tight with the government, like I said before. And you could end up at the bottom of a dungeon on a slave ship. I mean, that's how they do business over there. You know, it's the 16th century. So you don't know what's going to happen. And so he ran away. He left the territory of Venice. Now, I'm oversimplifying it because I don't want to bore you with all the details. He ended up running away, leaving Venice. The father-in-law now said, I got an Aguna case on my hands. I think it was a Cohen, too, the father-in-law. And the daughter must have been very young, but she's Aris, and she didn't do Nisuin. So she could, in order for her to move on, give her a get. And this guy didn't want to give a get now because he said he got messed over financially. That's his claim. The father-in-law's claim is, no, you messed me over. You know, it's like that with these ugly cases. And this one got Beis Din A on his side. The other one got Beis Din B on his side. And like I say, if he left the territory of Venice, so what can you do? Well, the father-in-law, who was a Richie Rich, he had protection. He got the Venetian government to send the ambassador like to the other Medinas where the guy was holding out, including the Duchy of Mantua. He also was in Verona. He also was in Milan, I think, and Bologna. Doesn't matter to you. It was in different Medinas because Italy at that time was not a single country, but a whole bunch of independent political states, independent of each other. See, the ambassadors from place A to place B. It was like a separate country. And when Venturoso, the cousin, so what happened was that the father-in-law, after a whole bunch of attempts, finally enticed the cousin to come back to Venice, promising to settle all the money matters and do a get already, and let's move past this. And he did write a get, but he was Maser Modo beforehand that he's doing this under duress, because as soon as he came into the Venetian territory, he saw, in his opinion, he made a mistake, because now he's in the spider's web. You know, you're in unfriendly territory. You get arrested by the unfriendly police all the time. And if you argue with the father-in-law over anything financial, like I say, you end up in a dungeon. At least that's what he claimed. Therefore, he wasn't crazy about giving the get. He was Moser Modah beforehand. Notice he told people beforehand, I'm only doing this, you know, under duress. So here you have the big question of a get Meuso. This is a get that was forced, in which case it doesn't count. Or am I wrong? Is it possible that things count? You know, if the basin says that locally that it counts. What's called duress? It's complicated getting matters. It's very interesting, you know. But the question boiled down to why I said, well, what exactly called duress? Now, I just stopped for a second to take out two books. I have two for them. The subject of forced get is very complicated. It's not as simple as the public imagines, because usually we say any get that's Musa is no good. That's true a lot of the time. There are times when it is good. And I'll say it again. In this case, it seems that the get was administered by the Basin of Venice, which is a real basin. And so, you know, it should be that any question of get Musa shouldn't have arisen, but that's what the claim the guy made. I have in front of me two books I've picked up over the years. One is called Kfiya Beget by Gartner, and which is a fat volume. It's like part of the Otzer Poskim series. You know what the Otzer Poskim is? That I have most of them, if not all of them, but they're still like halfway through Ebenezer. If you work for the Otzer Poskim, it's a lifetime job. And he says over here, Seder Kfiya Begetal, in Yoni Kfiya Bonus Begirishin, Sobach HaSeder Tur Beis Yosef Kufla Medal, Likit Mikdivri Gedoli Rishon Machorim Bin Kfiya Bonus Beget. And I looked through it once, but it's very complicated, and I wasn't holding in it. But I have the Seder, it's very, very obvious authoritative Seder. There's another book I got years later, and that I liked more. It's called Eilu Shekofen Lahotzi. Yesodas Kolon Balochus Bedinei Kfiya Beget. And it's from Yosef Goldberg, Dayan Basin, Adin, Rabboni Bira Kodesh Yerushalayim. I don't know who he is. It's from 2013. And this is very nice. He's upstairs and the downstairs, of course. And the point I'm making is the regular public doesn't understand, why would they, you know, that it's not so simple that you can never force a get, and except in the very small number of cases listed in the Shulchan Aruch, and what constitutes pressure, not pressure, things like this. And believe me, he's got unbelievable marmakomas. Sometimes you kind of do. I'm oversimplifying because I'm not going into a shir now, but it's not as simple as it sounds. And so when Ari Chassan Ben Teruso said that he was coerced into doing so, he was Meisr Modah, even though he went ahead and did the get, and as they do in getting, he was, you know, Bittel Modahs. He said, I'm doing this, I'm mevatel any mental reservations I may have claimed to have had, verbal reservations. In spite of everything, he did the get. He didn't get his money, if I remember correctly. Then he fled Venice, the territory of the Republic of Venice. He ends up in Mantua. And then he came out and said like this, this get is no good because it was forced. Now, I don't know how to read this. Maybe he's a schmo, like you find somebody's husbands who, you know, are do outrageous things these days with their goodness and so forth. You know, people won't give their wife a get. On the other hand, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he was an innocent guy and he was being messed over by his tyrannical father-in-law and he really did not want to give the get, but, you know, he found himself compelled to because he's scared he'll get knifed in Venice if he doesn't or something like that. It's, you know, sometimes when I read these over the years, sometimes I'm inclined to opinion A and sometimes to B. Oh, we know, I mean, because the Basin in Venice, which was led by Maran Padua, the big guy, told him, Kenosa Patar, get married or give her a get. No, don't leave things like this. They said that at the beginning, and he dragged it out. But on the other hand, the father-in-law and him, you know, were totally alienated from each other. So the girl seems like a pawn or something like that. If she was a young girl, 14, 15 years old, 16 years old, she probably was a pawn. We'll never know. The bottom, she did say Moy's alive, but maybe her father told her that. Now, who knows? I don't know. All I know is, when he came to Mantua, he told our hero, Moshe Provenzal, that the get was forced. Therefore, it's puzzled. And Moshe Provenzal heard him out. And then he said, you're right. And he wrote to the Basin of Venice. And he said, don't let her get married again until we're mavar this whole union. And send all the information to me and my Basin. We'll pass it on. They said, no, you come to us. He said, no, you come to me or send the people to me. They got so angry. You're challenging us, Basin of Venice, and what do you know? And so on and so forth. And once again, all hell broke loose. They appealed to all the rabbis to support them. They got a ton of rabbanim, a ton, to support the Basin of Venice, in other words, the girl's side, and say she's married, she can move on. Okay? And that it's outrageous. It violates the Chayim Rabbeinu Tam, as you know. You're not supposed to be motzi laz on getting, things like that. But other things as well. And they really did a drum roll of support. Each side published all kinds of kuntrasin and booklets and things to support their version of the facts. It's always what happens, you know. And there a lot of them are out now online if you want to go see them. That's all. It's again, this and that and the other. So maybe someday somebody will write a book on all this. Anyhow, a lot of rabbis and a lot of basins were against Provenzalo. They say, how dare you interfere in this? It's not your business. And second of all, who the heck are you? And what yeshiva do you learn in? The answer is none. And bigger people than you said to get is okay. And he didn't care. He said, I'm telling you my opinion. You do what you want. I'm telling you my opinion. Right? That's the kind of guy he was. And the people in Venice said to the people in Mantua, fire him. Now, the Ashkenazi community said, sure, we agree. They never liked him. His own people didn't agree. No, his own shul backed him. And so that's a weird business. You have the Mar in Padua, and it spread around the Europe, the Radbaz, and I mean the Mediterranean, the Mabit, all kind of big rabbis said that Promansala was wrong, and he's like a Zakan Mamre, and all kind of things like that. Now, I repeat, no one questioned that he's a heretic. And I would say no one questioned that he's not a Talmud Chacham. He clearly had that reputation. You know what I'm saying? Nobody questioned that he knows his stuff. But they question, I suppose, his judgment and character, which is just interesting, right? His judgment and character. And they said, you're not worthy to be a rabbi there because you won't bend to the will of the majority. Like, you know, who is it, Relezer, whatever, in the Tanu Shalach Noi, you know, in the Gemara, they, we quote, it's not exactly excommunication, but it's something like that, because he won't go along with the others. And he stood his ground, I don't care. To the discomfiture of his enemies, who sided with him? Rabbi Yosef Karo and his Beis Din. Not Rabbi Yosef Karo personally, he didn't write the letter, but his Beis Din, his Talmidim all wrote the letter. Well, that's a different story, right? You know, everybody can disagree with me. I have two people on my side, Rabbi Aaron Kotler and Moshe Feinstein. That's all you need. You know what I'm saying? So Rabbi Yosef Karo backed him, especially when Yosef Karo, a number of years early, had gone against him over that other fight about, you know, the guy he sent with the to publish the book in Sabinetta. So this time he's following with him. He was saying like this, I read the Chuvis, I read this guy's opinion, this guy's opinion. There is certainly a makom to say that the get is not a good get. Right? Well, the fight raged and raged. Raged and raged. I think it took 10 years. You see? And everybody wasn't talking to each other. And here he is in his own town. And half the town is not good with him. His own people totally back him. Wasn't good for Jewish unity. Let's put it that way. And as far as we can tell, he didn't care. He said, this is what I think. And Gemarnu, as long as he was backed by his own Kehillah, he could tell the rest of the people to jump in the lake. So that's more or less what happened. Now, again, there's a lot of details I can't go into for time, but it wasn't Pashut. And as time went on, let's put it this way, if Rabbi Yosef Karo supports you, as well as a couple of others, doesn't matter what everybody else says. If you're the girl, you're the family girl, do you want her to get married to somebody where Aliba the Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, which is a book that was being published at that time, right there in Italy, according to him, you're still an Ashes Ish. You don't want that. So de facto, whenever you have a substantial claim that the get is puzzle for whatever reason, because you need another get, that's the argument's going to win in real world. So in other words, after everybody screamed at him and dumped on him right and left, garbage and so forth, called him every name in the book, tried to get him fired, accused him of who knows what. By the way, they brought in the Geisha governments. It was the whole thing. You know, the Republic of Venice tried to get the Duke of Mantua to side with them, and Pantoroso had friends at the court of the Duke of Mantua, and there was also the Duchy of Ferrara nearby, and they got involved. I mean, it became a cause celebre that Goyisha governments, Catholic governments, were involved in this. And I remember at one point, one of the rabbis tell you, take this to the Catholic court, believe it or not. You know, I forget. It was an Inquisition, not the way you think the Inquisition means. It's a different meaning. The Catholic courts, and they should sort of like posket on the Shiloh, or decide which basin is right, or who is right with the cherims. What the heck does the Catholic Church have to do with this? You know? That's disgusting. This is what happens when you have these fights. They bring in the guy. You know? So it was a chil Hashem in that regard. In the long run, what happened? They finally did a second get. After a total period of 10 years from the beginning of the fair to the end, Relezer Ashkenazi, who's somebody else, visited Italy, and he brought the two sides together, I forget how. And I guess if you're the father of the girl, it's 10 years later, she's probably 24, 25, which is an old maid, she ain't come old in Renaissance Italy, if you're Jewish. And so I guess he must have been desperate or something like that. And so they finally settled somehow or other. They settled the financial side, and the second get was done, totally free will. And he moved in, and she moved on. But meanwhile, they made a train wreck. And everybody in the world, around the Mediterranean, whoever was a big rabbi at that time, it was in the 1560s, in Italy, in the Ottoman Empire, like in Salonika, in Constantinople, in Sfas and Eretz Yisrael, in Egypt, rabbis, everybody was weighing in on this controversial get, which, like I say, in the end, was solved the way it was solved. Now, our hero was at the eye of the storm. And I'll tell you again, they tried to get him fired. It didn't exactly work. And the reason is, you can't get somebody fired just because you strongly disagree with his halachic opinion, provided he arrived at his halachic opinion, you know, honestly and soundly, and he was considered a straightforward person, and he's a Bucky B'Shasa Poskin, and he had, you know, like we would say today, the judgment that you could call Das Torah. He was of that caliber. You can see even the people who cussed him out also write, oh, but he's a big gong. You know? In other words, you couldn't deny that he was a big person. You couldn't deny it, even though it hurt them to admit it. And because of that, he survived. And so even though he had a stormy career, he died in 1575, even though he had a stormy career, his legacy was one in which the later people, rabbis in Italy, like the Ramaz and others, they said, oh, Moshe Provençal, he said this, oh, then it counts a lot. You know, you can rely on him. And in later generations also, the references to him are with the greatest respect. So this is what happens in rabbinic sometimes. Just what happens when you're alive, which could be a lot of controversy. And then everybody dies and time goes by. And what survives is, you know, your argumentation, if it's still written. And it's not like you're living in 1560 and saying, how can you go against the basin of Rav Cheska de Saviato? I guarantee you, 100 years later, nobody heard of Cheska de Saviato, nor have you until this second. But Moshe Provençal, you say, oh, I look at his tshuvas, I look at his arguments, he's on the ball. Makes sense. You understand? Those ones in Latin you call it sine ira studio, without anger or prejudgment. Just read the arguments on the basis of it, and you'll see it, which is why this Sefer, which has only come out fairly recently from the Machon Yerushalayim, I'm not getting any money out of it, the Tshuvos of Moshe Provençal, that's why they're so interesting to read even now. You know what I'm saying? Because he has this way of, it seems to me, a very straightforward writing, and his arguments are you know, push-up shot straight up, and, you know, if it makes sense, it makes sense. I mean, I didn't go through all of them and see, you know, who agrees and who disagrees with it, but they have good footnotes. So they will bring that down. But the cases I told you rocked the world once upon a time. Especially, like I say, in the Mabit versus the Rav Yosef Karo. The Mabit and Rav Yosef Karo were both in Sfas. They had two opposing besins. They often disagreed on stuff. Both of them were great, great, great gedolim. You don't need me to tell you that. But this is one of the cases, the get of Venice was one of the cases in which the two basins disagree. You know what I'm saying? So you can have that. Anyway, that's what makes him such an interesting character. And as I say, one of those greatest rabbis you never heard of. Because I'm sure nobody till now, or till I mentioned the other day, heard of Rav Moshe Provençal, and wouldn't even mean anything if they did. But he was a gone idea. But from early generation, his tshuvas were not published until very recently. And therefore, in the rabbinic world, if your stuff doesn't get out in print, you kind of like disappear. And that's kind of what happened to him. Now, perhaps, what I'm saying today, other times, is part of a renaissance, a revival of the name, let's put it this way, Rav Moshe Provençal. As I said before, it's interesting because he is not Ashkenazic, not Sephardic, not Ashkenazic in the regular German Yiddish-speaking way. Let's put it this way. Is his own type, and there was among the Italiani, who were the smallest of the three Jewish groups in Italy, There was Ashkenazis fired in the locals and the Italiani. The Ashkenazis fired were bigger because they immigrated into Italy in larger numbers. The Italiani were the ones who were there all the way through since the time of Julius Caesar, you know. And they developed their own minhagim and their own sitter and their own everything in their way. And they had their own gedolim who called the shots their way. In other words, the way that made sense to them. Some of these minhagim are quite strange to you and I. I assume most of you are not Italian by background. And when I say Italian, it's got to be Italian, Italiani. If you're Italian, but you go back to an Ashkenaz shul, then you're Ashkenaz. If you're Italian, you go back to a Sephardic shul, you're a Sephard. I'm talking people who are mamish Italiani. That's very few. Had this very interesting tradition. It's a very interesting tradition. And they had their gedolim. Okay? They had their share of gedolim. So anyway, I want to wrap it up. I want to thank again Avrami Seeger for sponsoring this and sponsoring others. And I do look forward, as I said before, to when they publish the Chubas from Fleckles and the other good things that are coming out of that press. That's why I'm not even interested in acquiring old books. It's never appealed to me. I like new editions of old books. You get it? I like clean new editions with footnotes and all the rest of old books. That's what turns me on. Everybody's entitled to their own mishigas. It's not alcoholic, you know. You have different weaknesses. So that one is mine. But again, I want to thank Avrami Seeger, and I wish everybody a good week.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.